The men remained all too aware that these paper riches might never become real. Paul continued to manage his associate attorneys in secret in the hopes that they might uncover another hole in Edison's patent. Paul paid them from a combination of his own rapidly depleting savings and whatever scraps he could surreptitiously borrow from the firm's meager accounts. No day ended with a promise of the next. One September day, Agnes Huntington strode into his office. 4 months had passed since their goodbye in Nashville. She hadn't made an appointment. He hadn't written to her. He hadn't known what to say. Seeing her in front of him, he still didn't. He knew her secret. She knew his heart. They were in this way intertwined by the impossibility of their predicament. Miss Huntington. Once again, the name felt foolish on his lips after what had passed between them. But what else was he to call her? Good morning, Paul, she said as she shut the door behind her. It's good to see you, he said. He was telling the truth. Will you take a seat? The humid September air wafted in through the open windows. It had rained only that morning, and the breeze was damp. How is Nicola? She asked. He told her what he knew. He'd instructed his father not to use the inventor's name in letters, since they couldn't be sure if anyone was reading Paul's mail. Erastus was to speak only of the Tennessee sunflowers in their garden. As his father described the sunflowers, Paul would know that what he was really describing was Tesla. The old man hadn't liked this subterfuge, but he understood its necessity. His most recent letter had said that the flowers were blooming nicely. Not as tall as he'd hoped, but they were showing their color. Agnes complimented Paul on handling this with typical cleverness. Paul was proud to be clever in her eyes. Between them, they'd spent a lot of time in the company of geniuses over the past year. Clever would do just fine. And how is Mr. Jane? Paul asked. He still wasn't sure just why she'd come to see him. But this was the figurative elephant in the room. He couldn't go without mentioning it.
He's invited me to journey with him to Paris next month. 3 weeks of traveling and sightseeing through France. I haven't been since last I sang there. His family, well, they have their house in the city in Paris, and a summer cottage farther south near Lyon.
Of course they did. Are you to be married? The question was difficult to voice, but he had to know.
She swallowed. Paul, I...
She stopped herself. When she tried again, her voice was lighter.
I believe the purpose of the trip is so that he might propose.
Of course.
He'll offer me his grandmother's ring in Paris, I'd imagine. Then we can celebrate through the countryside for a few weeks before returning to Manhattan and Philadelphia to tell our respective families what they assuredly already know.
And you'll accept his proposal?
Paul.
What does he think of your performing at the Met? Surely he'll want you to stop.
Henry is a good man, she said. You think I must be compromising myself for his money? Well, let me tell you, he's a better man than most, and any woman would be lucky to have him. Just because he comes from money doesn't make him callow. And if you knew how much I've wanted to stop singing professionally or how many times I've almost quit, it is not the constant jockeying for position and stature that I love. I can sing for anyone. Henry doesn't have such a poor voice himself.
Her voice was firm, but her eyes were wet.
I understand, he said.
I respect your decision.
You haven't written me.
Nor you me. I've been trying to win this suit, or at least not to lose it.
So we're both playing games. You cannot blame me for winning mine just because you're losing yours.
They were silent for a moment. Paul wondered if she too felt like a pawn on someone else's board.
I didn't come to tell you that, said Agnes finally. I came about your case, about Westinghouse. I know you've been to every investor below 14th Street trying to scrounge up funds, and I know it's not going well. How do you... Paul didn't need to finish the sentence before he realized the answer. Jane. Of course he knows that you're my attorney. And he told me about your troubles, that every banker in town knows of them. But he told me something... Well, something that not every banker in town knows. He told me why you're having such a hard time. Why is that? J.P. Morgan? Morgan owns 60% of Edison General Electric, said Paul. Personally. Yes, she said. But think of what else he owns. His mind raced to see the implications of her suggestion. In addition to his controlling shares in EGE, Morgan possessed a piece of nearly half the companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange. This was the very reason that Westinghouse had hired Paul in the first place. Morgan's people have been visiting all of our prospective investors ahead of me. Morgan has been threatening them, invest even a dollar in Westinghouse's company and you'll be punished. It's smarter than that. Morgan didn't threaten them. He made them better offers. If they had capital that they were looking to invest during the crisis, he let them know they would be safer putting it into one of his companies. The Northern Pacific Railway, a few others. He offered them favorable terms, much better than anything you could have given them. He exploited their greed, not their fear. Paul could not deny the ingenuity. But how did he know who I was going to see? How did he get to them first? I don't know. He's J.P. Morgan. At this game, he's the best in the world. What she left unsaid was that this was precisely why Morgan and Edison would win in the end. Their kind always did. Manhattan would reward its own, and it would, at long last, cast Paul away. Far from Washington Square, far from Wall Street, far from Broadway, and very far from Agnes. From the depth of Paul's sadness came an iron resolve. We've found a few investors. I will find more. I won't give up. Agnes smiled. I know you won't, she said. From the moment I first met you, I knew you never would. And with that, it was time for her to go. He would need to begin looking for investors far outside New York. Would it make a difference? He didn't know. But at least she'd given him a better path to go down. They lingered for a moment at the doorway. He reached out to take her hand. But the instant he felt her fingers touch his, he knew he couldn't bear it. She pulled her hand away first. Was this just as difficult for her as it was for him? She turned, leaving without another word. It took Paul a moment before he was able to return to his desk. Chapter 52. End Times. I'm convinced that about half of what separates the successful entrepreneurs from the unsuccessful ones is pure perseverance. Steve Jobs. As the humid summer of 1889 cooled into fall, the tectonic plates beneath the global banking system began to shift. The rumor of the Baring brothers' disastrous speculation into Argentinian bonds hardened into admitted fact, and the debt that Edward Baring had built up over the years was revealed to be ever more precarious. A panic set in. The flowing pools of capital that streamed the very lifeblood of finance were poisoned. In September, the Bank of England stepped in to secure the Barings' losses, in the hopes of averting a worldwide depression. But by October, even the Bank of England's backing appeared insufficient. The British government lacked the capital necessary to bail out Sir Edward. Fortunately, Lord Rothschild added his family's muscle to the cause. He scolded the Chancellor of the Exchequer as if he were an immature child. But thankfully, as the November winds swept across the East Coast, and stiffened the collars of its bankers. New York held firm against London's downward pull. Wall Street was buoyed by a record summer of wheat production. Exports reached unprecedented highs. Even so, by the first frost of December, the three-card Monty that Paul had been playing as he shuffled Westinghouse's debts from investor to investor was revealing itself for the cheap trick that it had been. Doors that had opened to them in August were now closed. As fewer and fewer investments seemed safe, money had tightened. What little of it trickled across Manhattan would not make it all the way to Pittsburgh, and what larger pools might be available were closed off by the dam that was J.P. Morgan. The safety of alternating current was becoming more and more an accepted fact, and ever larger municipalities were choosing Westinghouse generators over Edison's. But what precious revenue was generated by the wiring of Elmira, New York, and even Baltimore, Maryland, did not come close to covering the company's expenses. The AC royalties they continued paying to Tesla's attorney, in the inventor's absence, only widened the gulf between the company and profitability. Financial schemes they had once mocked soon appeared necessary. The Westinghouse coffers leaked their last dimes. And in the face of corporate penury, Paul felt the unavoidable words slowly forming on his lips. Hughes said it first, not in the dim evening of one of their emergency conferences, but on a crisp morning as he first walked in the door. There was no preamble, there was no explanatory broaching of the subject. He just said it. "We must start to plan for the bankruptcy." Before Paul even knew what he was doing, he was saying it too. "I've been looking over the procedures," replied Paul instantly. "The 74 revisions to the 67 Bankruptcy Act are a bit Byzantine, but I know my way around them by now." It was as if they'd skipped over the agony of making a terrible decision and jumped straight to the mechanics of carrying it out. They spent all that morning developing a plan of action. The Westinghouse Electric Company's debts were numerous and their creditors varied. Of paramount importance was maintaining the distinction between Westinghouse's highly profitable rail business and his exceedingly unprofitable electrical endeavors. Westinghouse's air brakes would generate a healthy revenue for decades. The goal was to see that this could be leveraged into some manner of support for Westinghouse's other holdings. They sought to arrange things such that he might hold on to his home. It took less than a week to lay out the basic structure of the operation. It was an unemotional ordeal. The carving up of the Westinghouse corpse was performed with a clinical disassociation. Paul could devote himself to the complexity of the task and thus ignore its larger implications. Hughes's wife, Carter's daughter, was due to give birth to her first child before the new year. Paul's senior partners would move on to new cases, established careers, and full lives. What would happen to Paul was far less certain. It was a bright and clear Tuesday morning when Paul and his partners finished. The tired men surveyed the delicate paper stacks before them. New York was waking up, Paul thought, as they were finally ready to put Westinghouse to bed. Paul cradled the warm china cup in his hands, taking small sips of black coffee. Carter smoked. Hughes stared out the window as if somewhere in the bricks of the neighboring buildings was a place he'd rather be. "Well then," said Carter as he rested his cigar on the table, "who's going to tell him?" Chapter 53. The second most mysterious telegram that Paul had ever received. Many of life's failures are people who did not realize how close they were to success when they gave up. Thomas Edison. It was a long train ride to Pittsburgh. He'd made this trip many times over the past year and a half, but this journey felt infinitely longer. The gray Pennsylvania prairie stretched on endlessly. Paul felt that he was being delivered ever so slowly to the gallows. And what he felt as he approached the gilded noose more than anything else was shame. He kept imagining Westinghouse's face. Westinghouse had done everything right. He'd made the big gambles, and he'd gambled correctly. First on electrical light, then again on alternating current. He'd identified a future market, he'd identified the technological problems that would need solving in order to serve this market, and he'd then designed and manufactured the best product in the world to fill this niche. What more could one ask of a businessman? One could ask for a better attorney. If Carter had been in charge from the beginning, would they still be in this position? Could Hughes have negotiated their way out of it if he'd been given a chance? Could anyone? Why had George Westinghouse done something so foolish as to entrust the future of his company to Paul? Paul had been called a prodigy when he'd signed Westinghouse as his client, but he had not felt like one. And only now, as he came to the end of his brief career as a lawyer, was he aware of the extent of his previous accomplishments. Now that it no longer mattered, he realized what a marvel his early work had been. He'd made it far. How many people could claim that? And how many people had squandered such promise? Paul entered the Westinghouse Estate's central mansion wearily. The butler took his coat, his hat, his worn gloves. Mr. Westinghouse was in the study. Paul made his way slowly through the house. This would likely be his last time here. Westinghouse would remain cordial, to be sure. Marguerite might even extend the occasional invitation to dinner, but Paul knew that he wouldn't be able to bear attending. His shame was so deep that he could not imagine ever being able to look George Westinghouse in the eye again. Paul paused in the study's doorway. Westinghouse was seated at his enormous desk. He was absorbed in diagrams of some sort. Mechanical designs that, most likely, would never come into being. Paul waited there for a long moment. He took the longest breath of his life before he opened his mouth. "Mr. Westinghouse," said Paul, "we need to talk." Westinghouse didn't look up. "Yes, yes," he said, still focused on his diagrams. "Take a seat, kid." Paul didn't feel like sitting. He stood there another moment, marshaling his strength. There was a loud knock at the door. "Come in," called out Westinghouse. The butler entered. "Pardon, sir, but there's a telegram just arrived, marked urgent." "Fine, fine," said Westinghouse. "Bring it here." "It's for Mr. Cravath." Carter and Hughes wouldn't have interrupted him at such a moment. They'd wanted to be as far away from this meeting as possible. Who even knew he was here? Paul took the telegram from the butler and peeled open its wax seal. This was easily the second most mysterious telegram he'd ever received. "The Tennessee sunflowers have bloomed," the message read. "They are the most beautiful sight. You must see them for yourself. Please come to Nashville post haste." It was signed, A.G. Chapter 54. Tea Time at the Cravath Household. At the heart of science is an essential balance between two seemingly contradictory attitudes. An openness to new ideas, no matter how bizarre or counterintuitive they may be, and the most ruthless, skeptical scrutiny of all ideas, old and new. This is how deep truths are winnowed from deep nonsense. Carl Sagan. "Where's Tesla?" were the first words that Paul spoke to Agnes, improbably seated in his parents' Nashville kitchen. Ruth Cravath was heating the kettle for tea while Erastus puttered about, making sure Agnes had everything she required. She had evidently been here a few days. Paul could not help but notice the bright diamond on Agnes's ring finger. He tried not to stare. It probably cost more than the entire house in which they were seated, though that wasn't saying much. At least he would not have to ask whether her trip to France with Henry LeBarge-Jane had gone according to plan. Paul, cautioned Erastus, that's not a very friendly way to greet our guest. Where is Mr. Tesla, Father?
He's usually back by dinner time.
Usually? Agnes was more sympathetic to Paul's understandable confusion. A week ago, I received a letter from Wilhelm Röntgen. The name meant nothing to him.
All right.
He's a professor at the University of Würzburg. Fascinating. Paul, said Ruth, would you like some tea?
Mother, said Paul, growing frustrated, please give me a moment with my friend.
At the word friend, Ruth raised an eyebrow. Mr. Röntgen informed me that he'd been receiving letters from one Nikola Tesla, weekly.
Who let Tesla send letters? Paul looked accusingly at his father.
Nikola wanted to send letters to a scientist in Germany, said Erastus. I did not think this would endanger him.
Damn it, said Paul. That is precisely what will endanger him.
Your language, castigated Erastus.
So that is what brought me here, said Agnes. Because Röntgen wrote to me to say that he'd been having the most enlivening correspondence with Tesla and hoped to meet with him on an upcoming visit to America. But Tesla had said that wouldn't be possible unless I'd given permission, which Röntgen asked for.
Why you? Asked Paul.
Agnes stared at him.
Because, she said calmly, he trusts me.
For whatever reason, she was the one whom Tesla had gone to after the fire. It was in her house that he'd made a temporary home. Agnes had little family. Tesla had none. Together they'd made the most unexpected of siblings.
If he'd been writing to Röntgen, perhaps he was writing to others. The community of scientists is small, as you've taken pains to make me aware.
I'd taken the season off from performing anyway, given my other voyages. I came here to make sure he hadn't been found. Across the room, Paul's parents seemed perfectly comfortable with all that was happening.
So he's safe, said Paul.
You should see it. What he's done. It's magical.
What's he done?
Her face crinkled.
It's very difficult to explain.
Is it a new light bulb? Asked Paul eagerly. A completely original AC lamp? That's what he'd been working on.
Perhaps, interjected Ruth, the simplest way to clear this up would be a visit to Mr. Tesla's laboratory after tea.
His laboratory? Sputtered Paul. Where is Mr. Tesla's laboratory?
There passed a moment of silence. The only sound was the clatter of four cups being set by Ruth against their saucers. Agnes turned to Erastus.
You should tell him, she said to Paul's father. It was your idea.
Chapter 55 Fisk. The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand rapt in awe, is as good as dead. Albert Einstein.
How could you build him a laboratory? Paul asked his father as their carriage wound down the dirt road toward Fisk University. The horses kicked up clouds of dust, coating the air in a dull beige sheen.
He built the laboratory himself, said Erastus. I just gave him some unused space in the basement.
I've never seen anything like it, supplied Agnes from the carriage's back seat, what he's built there.
Once again, I'll ask without expectation of being answered, what is it that he's built there?
Oh, son, said Erastus, I'm not much for the natural sciences. You'll have to ask him yourself.
Agnes shrugged.
I never even got a handle on the whole AC versus DC issue, and the man lived in my maid's room for months.
Paul fidgeted in his seat as the Fisk campus came into view. Though only a quarter century old,
The school had blossomed from a lecture hall for freedmen on an abandoned army barracks into a 1,000-student institution. A half dozen stone buildings all designed in the Gothic style. Paul had been 4 years old when his father helped to found Fisk. He had little memory of those days, but the story had lived on at his family's dinner table. The first class had consisted entirely of former slaves, men as young as 7 and as old as 70, few of whom had much experience with a book, much less any sort of formal education. With the support of the Freedmen's Bureau and the American Missionary Association, the school had thrived. It had recently educated its first second-generation applicant, the teenage son of a former cotton picker from a West Tennessee plantation. Paul entered the basement laboratory of Jubilee Hall to find a vibrant Nikola Tesla huddling in a semicircle with 5 Negro students. The men's backs were to the door, so none saw the entry of Paul's group. Tesla and his students were too deeply engaged in something happening on a wide metal table in front of them to notice that anyone had come in.
"Move the plate," Tesla commanded one of the students. "One additional foot. Yes. Stop."
Tesla fiddled with a device on the table while another eager assistant moved to what Paul thought might be a generator on a nearby tabletop.
"You just say the word," said this student assistant. All the students were in suits of either brown or light gray. Not a button had been loosened on their collars. Not a roll was to be found upon their shirt sleeves. They had apparently inherited their teacher's obsession with neatness.
"Robert," said Tesla without looking up from his device, "climb aboard the table."
The students exchanged confused glances.
"Pardon, sir," replied the tallest of them.
"Mr. Robert Miles," said Tesla, "lift your corpse aboard this table."
"You want me to stand on the table?" said Robert.
"No," said Tesla. "You will not stand. I want for your laying yourself in front of the tube."
Though this did little to clarify matters, Robert moved as instructed. He had clearly been studying with Tesla for some time and knew better than to question one of his teacher's demands, no matter how odd. Robert heaved himself onto the table and lay down with his feet pointing toward Tesla, his head aimed toward a silvery plate that rested on the tabletop, reflecting slices of light across the room.
"Revolve," said Tesla.
Robert, after performing a quick Tesla-to-English translation, turned his body 90 degrees. His long legs hung off the wide end of the table and his head drooped out of Paul's sight over the other side.
"Like this?" asked Robert.
"Just as so," answered Tesla. "Now please raise your right leg."
Robert strained to balance his leg in the air as Tesla adjusted something on the device before him.
"Mr. Jason Barnes," said Tesla into the air. "Current now, please."
A student by the generator turned 2 metal knobs. The machine began to hum.
"And here you will have it,"
said Tesla proudly as he turned something on the device before him. The student near the silver plate watched it closely. Robert did his best to remain perfectly still on the table. The whole of the room seemed to breathe in with a nervous anticipation as long, tense seconds followed Tesla's proclamation. Nothing whatsoever happened. 10 seconds of awkward silence lengthened into 20. Neither Tesla nor his students did so much as look up from the table. Paul was quite confused.
"Aha!"
Tesla declared. He stood suddenly, the full length of his frame rearing up over the huddle of men around him.
"Mr. Robert Miles, you may disembark."
Robert hopped off the table. The students all stared at the silver plate. To Paul's surprise, it was now growing black.
"You will all be patient for a moment," said Tesla. "The salts are having their reaction."
It was only then that Tesla noticed his visitors.
"Mr. Paul Cravath,"
said Tesla with a smile.
It is pleasing to visit you.
And you too, replied Paul. On the faraway shores of Tesla's mind, visitors came and went. As to how they arrived or departed, Tesla seemed neither to know nor to care. What is it that you created here? Said Paul. He did not recognize the device on the table, but if it either was or prefigured the device that Westinghouse needed, Paul felt certain he would not be able to resist physically embracing Tesla, whether the inventor liked it or not.
In scant seconds, you shall see. Come, come, come.
Tesla motioned for Paul and company to join him and his students across the makeshift laboratory. The assembled devices and machines were less gargantuan than those destroyed in his burned-down New York lab, and yet their variety seemed at least as impressive. Glass objects of every shape that Paul might imagine lined one wall. Mushroom bulbs and fat circles and long, delicate spheres. Each was perfectly clear, hand-polished into dustless radiance. Another wall held what seemed to be electrical components. The wound copper coils, spidery antennas, and precisely weighted gears that formed the backbone of all of Tesla's work. With these tools, Tesla harnessed the mysterious liquid of electrical energy and built from it something. The alternating current motor had been only the first act of his performance. The giant coil of lightning Paul had seen in New York had been the second. Would an entirely new form of light bulb be the third? Would there be any end to the wonders that Nikola Tesla might conjure into the world?
Come, regard, Mr. Cravath and Miss Agnes Huntington, said Tesla. I call it a shadowgraph.
Tesla directed his guests' attention to the once silver plate. It was now mostly pitch black, with ghostly silver forms tracing through its center. It took Paul a moment to make out the shape etched in silver. It was a bone.
Is that?
Asked Agnes, coming to the same realization.
It's my femur, said Robert. It's inside my leg.
Nikola,
said Erastus. Did you just take a photograph of the inside of this man's leg?
No, no, replied Tesla. Not a photograph. It is a shadowgraph. It records density of matter, not brightness of illuminations. On the shadowgraph, that which is of greatest density is lightest. That which is of none is dark.
It strips away the skin, said Agnes, and reveals an image of the bone underneath?
Precisely, said Tesla.
Quietly. In secret, from an impromptu subterranean laboratory in the Tennessee plains, Tesla had teamed with the precocious sons of southern freedmen to engineer wonders stranger than anything Edison and his well-heeled peers might have dreamed. Paul had once thought that Thomas Edison was the most American man of his generation. But looking around the work table before him at Tesla and his students carefully considering their darkening plate, Paul saw another America. This one had been born in an impoverished Serbian village and a West Tennessee cotton field. Where the first America was brilliant, the second was ingenious. What the first America did not invent, the second would tinker into being. What Wall Street would not fund, a Nashville basement would build. This was what men like Edison and Morgan feared. With checkbooks such as theirs, with the ability to buy and sell a place like Fisk with a single pen scribble, they still slept badly in their Fifth Avenue redoubts. They used their lawyers to batter down places just such as this. They had their patents, their carefully worded claims to preeminence. Tesla and his students had only their inventiveness. Paul saw on the faces of Robert and Jason and their peers that what these men did was not for money. It was not for class or some abstract social achievement. These men built things because they were smart.
They were eager, and they were precocious, and they were curious. Paul wanted always to live in an America in which Thomas Edison would fear a smart kid in a basement whose father had harvested enough cotton that his son might harvest volts.
"Does it hurt?" Erastus asked Robert.
The student instinctively looked toward his leg and wiggled it.
"I don't think so."
"You are quite well," said Tesla. "So you witnessed the machine's operation. Mr. Wilhelm Röntgen shall be pleasing."
"This is what I've come to discuss with you," said Paul. "You've grown healthy again, your memory has returned, and so has your genius. I cannot tell you how happy I am to see it. This machine, or any of the others along the walls, is it an incandescent lamp?"
Tesla looked at Paul as if he were the one whose speech was largely indecipherable.
"Why is it that they would be lamps?
A light bulb designed to make the most use of AC?" offered Paul. "Something that would clearly in no way infringe on Edison's patent. This is what Westinghouse needs to survive the lawsuit. That's what you were working with his team to build. Can the device that you've created here help them in that regard?"
Tesla came the closest to laughing that Paul had ever seen him.
"Oh, Mr. Paul Cravath, I have told you. Who is caring about light bulbs? We have them already. Now this, which I have built, Mr. Wilhelm Röntgen calls it an X-ray, though I am liking my shadow graph more aptly. I have sent him my designs so that he may build these machines. This is a new thing. This is a wonder."
"What the hell is anyone supposed to do with this X-ray?" said Paul.
If any man alive could save Paul's career, his livelihood, it was Tesla. And yet he wouldn't, or couldn't. Perhaps for him there wasn't even a difference. Paul cared about Tesla. Would Tesla ever care about him in return? He wasn't sure. Tesla was unwilling to engage his mind in anything but his own daydreams, not even to save his only friends in the world. Tesla noticed the defeated look on Paul's face.
"What is it that is the matter, Mr. Paul Cravath?"
"Paul is losing his lawsuit, Nikola," said Agnes. "He's worried that Thomas Edison is going to win." Tesla nodded sympathetically.
"I have sadness about this also."
Paul realized that there was a lot that had happened of which Tesla was unaware. He started talking fast. Maybe this would be his one chance to impress upon Tesla the importance of his work on AC. Paul told the assembled everything, sparing no grisly detail of the past year. Damn confidentiality. His client had nothing to hide. The students took their seats, rapt with attention. It was quite a tale. Paul watched Erastus's face when he got to Westinghouse's looming bankruptcy. There was little reaction. Erastus did not give Paul the sympathy he'd imagined, but neither did he present Paul with the pity he'd feared. His sorry tale completed, Paul stood gloomily in the center of the room. What was there for anyone to say?
"Hmm," said Robert.
Paul turned, surprised to hear his voice.
"Robert," said Erastus, "if you've got something to add, you should add it."
Robert looked to his college president, then to Paul, then to Tesla.
"Well, it's only..." Robert fidgeted. "Mr. Tesla says that there are two types of problems out there. On the one hand, you've got problems that people have been struggling over, solving or not solving forever, known problems. But then, on the other hand, you've got problems that no one ever even thought to tackle, new problems, uncharted ground, right? Unknown problems."
"It is eloquently more so when I say it," added Tesla, "but Mr. Robert Miles is correct."
He nodded at his student appreciatively. Somehow, thought Paul, Nikola Tesla had ended up being a surprisingly good instructor.
"And so," said Paul, "sir, I don't mean to tell you your business, but when we're faced with a problem, Mr. Tesla has us, first and foremost, categorize it. We have to determine if it's known or unknown. Have you done that with yours?
I suppose, said Paul, that defeating Edison is an unknown problem since no one has ever... Paul stopped himself.
No, wait, he continued. Edison has been beaten before. He told me so himself when I deposed him.
Well, explained Robert, if it's that type of problem that you're trying to solve, then your first step should probably be to go to someone who's solved it already.
There is exactly one person who's gone up against Thomas Edison and won, said Paul.
And you're suggesting that he might have some interesting advice to share.
Agnes smiled.
She had already realized whom Paul meant.
Your epiphany is pleasing, said Tesla.
Well, said Erastus impatiently, who is it?
Paul told them. He couldn't believe he hadn't thought of this earlier.
How do you think you might reach him? Asked Erastus.
I imagine I'll give him a ring on a telephone, said Paul. After all, he did invent the thing.
Chapter 56 At the Foot of Ben Vrea. That's been one of my mantras, focus and simplicity. Simple can be harder than complex. You have to work hard to get your thinking clean, to make it simple. But it's worth it in the end, because once you get there, you can move mountains. Steve Jobs. It turned out that Alexander Graham Bell did not own a telephone. 14 years earlier, Bell had patented an apparatus for transmitting vocal or other sounds telegraphically. A dozen other inventors, chief among them Thomas Edison, had been working on similar designs for a telegraph that could transmit the human voice itself. The uses and applications were tantalizingly lucrative. But Bell had beaten all his rivals, filing his patent mere hours before a nearly identical claim from Elisha Gray and weeks ahead of another from Edison. The lawsuits that resulted were still ongoing, and yet thus far Bell had won them resoundingly. His telephone patent was ironclad. The invention, easily among the most significant in the world, had positioned him to be the most important inventor of his age. However, to the great shock of the scientific community, Bell had opted not to build the devices himself nor to bring them to the market. Instead, he appointed a distant relative to manage the company that bore his name. Bell and his wife controlled more shares of the Bell Telephone Company than anyone else, and yet he steadfastly refused to have any involvement in its operation. Once his shares were comfortably generating millions per year in revenue, Bell had taken his family and moved to a remote Canadian peninsula. Alexander Graham Bell had beaten Thomas Edison at his own game and then vanished. Paul and Agnes spent a week traveling from the dusty fields of Nashville to the quiet harbor of Bell's frozen lake. Before they left, Agnes sent Henry Jane a note to say that she was taking a last-minute trip with her mother. She sent her mother a note to say that she was staying another week in Nashville. Paul pointed out that Fanny would be sure to send a sternly worded reply, but Agnes only shrugged. She wouldn't be there to receive it.
What can she do? She'll yell when I get home. There will be a great row. She'll lock me up till the very day of my wedding, I'm sure. But at least before all of that, I will have done this.
They passed the 1,800-mile trip to Canada pleasantly. Happily, even. He finally brought himself to ask about her engagement, but they skipped through the painful details as quickly as possible. The wedding would not take place until the following July. It would take some time to organize. Everyone in New York, not to mention Philadelphia, would be in attendance. Everyone, Paul assumed, but himself. That unpleasantness concluded, Paul and Agnes then had 6 days on a train together. The train became its own world,
a glowing filament enclosed in a vacuum. Removed from the society of New York, they had only to be themselves. Paul wasn't a young lawyer on the make. Agnes was not the star chanteuse of the Metropolitan Opera. They were just a good, strong boy from Tennessee and a whip-smart wit from Kalamazoo. In the midst of all that was happening, it was actually fun. They made friends with a newlywed couple just across the border. When the bride gestured to Agnes's ring and asked about their coming nuptials, Paul realized that this trip was almost like a honeymoon. Before he could correct their assumption, Agnes answered, "September!" To Paul's surprise, he found himself joining in her lie. Together, they concocted an entire story of their lives. Names, dates, a fictional romance that was soon to culminate in an imagined wedding. Alice Boone and Peter Sheldon were Tennessee mining heirs off to visit distant Canadian relatives. The foursome played bridge till all hours of the night. The irony was not lost on Paul that he felt most himself here, on the train, at play under a false name. Agnes seemed to feel the same way. Agnes Googe was pretending to be Agnes Huntington, pretending to be Alice Boone. Paul was pretending to be someone who was permitted to love her. They were the king and queen of the first-class dining car. But a proper honeymoon this was not. Each night they returned to their separate sleeping cars. Paul was not an adulterer, he assured himself. They shared not one stolen kiss as their train skirted the snowy Gulf of Maine. Not even their fingertips touched over 6 days. The only occasion on which Paul felt the soft warmth of her skin took place within the safety of his dreams. These were vivid. Westinghouse had made the introduction to Bell via telegram, having known him casually from years of engineering conferences. Bell had replied that he did not often receive visitors, remote as his home was. He would thus be delighted to receive some intelligent company for lunch. Paul guessed that this was easily the longest distance he would ever travel for salmon sandwiches and a pot of tea. Bell and his wife Mabel lived on a 600-acre estate on the island of Cape Breton in Nova Scotia. Nestled within the indigo rim of Bras d'Or Lake, the estate occupied its own private peninsula. Mr. Bell and Mabel had named the place Banvria. It was Gaelic for beautiful mountain, in reference to the rising slopes just across the harbor, in the shadow of which rested their secluded kingdom. Paul and Agnes's carriage climbed a lush hill, leaving the sky-blue lake and the red rock formations of the bay behind them. The shape of Bell's home suddenly came into view. To describe the structure as palatial would have been not understatement, but misidentification. It resembled a small city more than any sort of house. The Bell compound was a series of interlocking buildings stretching out from a three-story mansion in the center to nearby sheds, cabins, boathouses, warehouses, laboratories, and servants' cottages. Through the thick woods, paths had been carved to connect most of these structures to one another. Some buildings were even linked by covered passageways for pedestrian travel in the snowy winter. The style of the estate stood in some contrast to its size, for its dark wood rustic design gave the impression that the whole thing had blossomed from the great forest around it. Alexander and Mabel Bell waited outside to greet their arriving guests. A row of servants claimed the travelers' valises, scurrying their bags into the house as Paul and Agnes shook the hands of their hosts.
"Good Lord," said Mr. Bell. "George said you were young, but he did not say you were still in your swaddling clothes."
Bell was large, almost as tall as Paul. While only 42 years of age, Bell was possessed of a face that made him look much older. His white mutton-chop beard, 4 inches in length, completed the effect. Yet the man, easily richer than any of the other inventors Paul had met, wore loose work pants tucked into his faded boots. His vest did not match his coat,
and instead of a proper tie, he wore a simple kerchief around his neck. Mabel wore her gray hair tied back into a schoolgirl's bun. Her beige coat had been designed for warmth, not for fashion, and her plain linen dress did not appear to have been sewn within the past decade. "You must be the famed Miss Huntington," said Belle, kissing her outstretched hand. "I regret never having seen you on the stage, but now we must make an effort to get to New York more often."
"I'm flattered," replied Agnes, "but if you can dig up a piano, I'll spare you the train fare."
There followed an hour of pleasant introductions as Paul and Agnes sipped tea in one of the mansion's many sitting rooms. Mabel talked about their time on the lake, how their children had learned to sail, and how lovely it was for the family to take picnics in the wooded hills. Every Christmas day the children were allowed to toboggan down the cape and across the solid ice. Mabel watched them each year with her heart pounding. Mr. Bell described the laboratory he'd built just yards down the dirt path, eagerly promising to give his guests a tour after lunch. He'd been working on hydrofoils, gasoline-powered ships that glided just above the surface of the water. He'd begun work on a flying machine as well, a winged device that threatened to carry its occupant as far as a few hundred feet through the air. He'd exchanged a few encouraging letters with a pair of bicycle designers from Ohio at work on something similar. Bell's own work wasn't as far along, but early tests were promising. Sure enough, an old rosewood piano made its appearance. Agnes sang, "You'll Miss Lots of Fun When You're Married." Mabel accompanied her on the piano. The older woman lost her fingerings a few times, the chords shifting into accidental minors. Agnes covered the mistakes with a smile and a higher harmony, her musicianship skilled enough to make up for her partner's lack thereof. There was much laughter in the sun-dappled drawing room. Paul waited until everyone's cup had been drained of its tea before broaching the subject of their visit. "The elegance of your home, Mr. Bell, certainly befits the only man alive who can claim to have bested Thomas Edison."
"I will take my cue to check on the salmon," said Mabel as she stood.
"No, no," said Paul. "Please, you needn't leave. It's only that we've found ourselves in dire straits, and we've come to you for guidance."
"Well, then, I hope you find what you've come for," replied Mabel. "But for my part, I did not move to Canada so that I could spend another minute of my life talking about Thomas Edison."
Bell watched her go, a loving smile on his face, as his wife shut the wooden door behind her. "She exaggerates," said Bell as he was left alone with Paul and Agnes. "She unfortunately still has to spend more than a few minutes of her life talking about Edison, though I try to leave her out of it."
"How do you mean?" asked Agnes.
"How many times do you two think I've been sued by the Wizard of Menlo Park?" he asked. "Mr. Westinghouse has been sued 312 times by Edison," answered Paul. "I cannot imagine you faced a lesser onslaught."
"My lawyers summarized it for me in a letter," said Bell. "In the past decade and a half, between Edison, Elisha Gray, and their friends at Western Union, I've been sued more than 600 times over that silly telephone business."
Paul and Agnes were dutifully impressed by the insanity of this figure.
"Have you ever tried one?" asked Bell.
"One what?" said Paul.
"A telephone, of course."
"I haven't yet."
"I have," said Agnes. "It was thrilling."
"It wears off quickly," said Bell. "Horrid things. Infernally loud. As soon as you wire one up, the damned bell never stops ringing. That's why I won't keep one around. All that fuss over something so annoying. Do you know I keep a place in Washington just for the lawsuits? The Supreme Court sits in the fall, so the lawyers like me to spend a few months down there every year to testify in person as Edison and his cronies rake my name through the mud."
"Washington is lovely in the autumn," suggested Agnes.
"I practically never leave the courthouse when I'm there. I make my yearly pilgrimage, raise my right hand, tell everyone the same boring story of that first telephone call. Mr. Watson, come here. Like many future telephone conversations, it was rather less interesting than one might hope. I tell my story, and the court rules again and again that my patent is valid. Edison and his boys go back to New York to skulk around until they find another reason to sue me.
You've won every single one of those 600 suits, said Paul. It's remarkable.
It helps that I did actually invent the thing, said Bell. Not that that always makes a difference. But this is what inventing has become in America, thanks to you lawyers. Courtrooms are the new laboratories, and you prefer the older kind. If you've come here for advice, my friend, then you're welcome to the very best advice I have. Get out while you still can. This was not what Paul had come to hear. Bell might be old and comfortable with retirement, but he was not.
The Westinghouse Electric Company is soon to declare bankruptcy, confessed Paul. Edison is going to win the light bulb suits.
You can't be saying that in my position you'd just as well let him.
No, said Bell.
I'm saying that in your position, I'd have let Edison win a long time ago.
Bell stood, stretching his legs with a stroll to the tall windows. He gazed out at the maple trees for a moment before he spoke again.
What is it that you think you're fighting for?
We're fighting for the future of this nation, said Paul.
You're not, said Bell softly. You're fighting for money.
Or honor, which is worse.
What are you fighting for? Asked Agnes. You haven't let Edison steal your patent?
Bell turned to Agnes.
What do you think, Miss Huntington? Why do I go to Washington each fall?
She seemed to find something in his eyes. Something silent and tender passed between them at a pitch that Paul could not hear. Agnes smiled.
You do it for her. For Mabel.
And my girls, said Bell. But I control no company. I file for no other patents. Defending the royalty I have is enough trouble for one life. You want to make a fortune, Mr. Cravath? You already have. You're George Westinghouse's attorney, not even 30. And you've a woman by your side who, let me add, is as lovely and charming and smart as any man of your generation might hope to marry. It doesn't seem so bad.
Paul reddened in the face. He thought about correcting Bell, but to his surprise, saw Agnes quickly motion him to be still.
In my laboratory here, said Bell, I can work on any problem I choose. I can tinker all day on any device that strikes my fancy. I am free of the terrors of public opinion that so torture Thomas Edison. I am free of the dull pains of manufacturing that so weigh down George Westinghouse. That is winning. To sit in the dark and create things. That's how we all started.
Yet somehow we all forgot that when we allowed our days to become consumed by bickering over which of us first ran which current through which wire.
Who cares?
He turned to Paul as he continued.
The future you're fighting for, it belongs to the money men, not the inventors.
Leave the former to their well-appointed hell, and tell the latter to join me here, where only genius matters, and only wonder thrives.
Alexander Graham Bell was, in this speech, as decent a man as Paul had met in years.
You are one of the smartest men in the world, Mr. Bell. Don't tell me you think I'm going to stop.
Bell gave a laugh.
No, Mr. Cravath, he said. I don't.
He gazed again at the thick maple trees stretching for miles outside his window. He seemed lost in a series of thoughts that Paul was sure he would never understand.
You really hate him, don't you? Asked Bell.
You don't?
I pity him. You will not understand why I am doing this today, and you will not understand why I am doing this tomorrow. But when you do, well, just please remember that I warned you. I'm going to tell you what you want to know. I'm going to tell you how to defeat Thomas Edison. And I think you're going to be successful. But please remember this. I'm not going to do it for you. I'm going to do it for him.
Chapter 57 The Reverse Salient.
We often miss opportunity because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work.